Muslims will fight them, and they will be hiding themselves behind the trees and the rocks. Even the trees and the rocks, they hate the Jews. And the trees and the rocks would say, Ya Abdullah, O servant of Allah, come, there is a Jew behind me, kill him.
وضغطت برجالها مسيوجة
مسيوجة
لهل العدا سم وطريق اللاوي ولهل الهدى واد وساع فجوجة مرقى براسه والشرف متساوي واسمعهم
This is Radio Jihad.
Radio Jihad. Radio Jihad. Radio Jihad.
Global Security Matters.
Good evening. It's Friday, the 22nd of July, 2011. I am Adrian Morgan. This is Global Security Matters, and with me is my co-host, Reese Cup. Do you want to say hello, Reese?
Hello.
Hello. Now, today we've had news of two horrific attacks happening virtually simultaneously in Oslo, the capital of Norway. That will be one of the main features of the show tonight. Also, a little brief recap of what's been going on at the moment. On Wednesday in Germany, a man called Omid H. has been arrested. This is an individual who since July last year has made 60 posts onto a jihadist web forum calling for terror activities, and it's taken them a whole year to finally arrest the man and accuse him of being a recruiter for Al-Qaeda. And apparently he's an Afghan individual. Today in British news, a couple, a man and a woman, have been arrested in Afghanistan, again on terrorism charges, believed again to be recruiting for Al-Qaeda. And this is the first arrests of people connected with Britain since 2001. There used to be quite a few people going in a pipeline to Afghanistan. Since then, there's been a lot of British people who've been found dead after shootouts with police or in bombing campaigns. But this is an Afghan man and woman who also have dual nationality, who are also apparently British. And they have been arrested on suspicion of trying to carry out terrorism attacks. There's a bit more information. I mean, Pakistan, for example, there is a man called Saeed Nabi Fai, or Fai, F-A-I, who's being accused by U.S. prosecutors of trying to push influence so that American politicians will be trying to vote to make Indian Kashmir become Pakistani Kashmir. Kashmir is in the north of India, and it's always been a source of dispute between Pakistan and India. They were both granted independence at exactly the same time. Within 1 month of each other, they became independent nations. Pakistan, under Muhammad Ali Jinnah, didn't want to become part of India. And now, Yousaf Gilani, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, is now saying that he really wants to cooperate with America. I think it's a little bit late now for him to be saying things like that. I think what's coming out from this individual, this Fai character in Washington, now obviously he hasn't been convicted yet, and anybody is innocent until proven guilty, but the prosecutor's case is that he has been funded by the ISI, that's Inter-Services Intelligence, the Pakistani equivalent of the CIA, though it's more militaristic, and it's pretty much how the CIA used to be viewed in the past as being involved with, let's say, black ops. ISI is notorious for doing the dirty work that Pakistan doesn't want to be seen to be doing publicly. It's been involved. It set up the Taliban, for example, who now we are fighting against. And it purports to be fighting the Taliban now that Pakistan is supposedly an ally of America, while at the same time it's also giving support to the Taliban. This is the great conundrum that is Pakistan's politics today. I don't want to dwell on that too much because obviously that's a court case which needs to be brought to fruition. But one thing, Steve Emerson did a very good article in the Investigative Project on Terrorism about this. What he didn't mention is that it's also, there are people in London, there are two people in London who are also being accused of doing exactly the same things. It seems that Pakistan is willing to throw lots and lots of money at people to try and pressure them to change the politics. What is also interesting, that other groups, we have groups like Mumbai, where they had the Lashkar-e-Toiba 2 years ago, where they did that massive attack and 160 people died. That attack, Lashkar-e-Toiba, was set up in Pakistan with the assistance and the full knowledge of the ISI, who allowed it to happen, because a lot of the jihadist groups in Pakistan were all set up because they were saying that they were going to fight the Indian occupiers of this disputed territory. Kashmir is split in two. They have a so-called line of control, and you've got on the western side, you have the POK, Pakistan Occupied Kashmir, and on the eastern side, you have Jammu and Kashmir, which is under Indian control, of which the capital is Srinagar. And a lot of these jihadist groups, which were set up and funded and supported, and Pakistan's ISI turned a total blind eye to their activities, were all initially geared to fight against Indian-occupied Kashmir. They wanted to take it all over. Irrespective of the fact that in the 1940s, in fact, in 1946, 2 years before independence, the leader of Kashmir, the sultan of that region, agreed that he was quite happy for India to take charge of it and not for it to go to Pakistan. But the Pakistanis don't want to see that. They want to claim it as a Muslim land. They have had no legitimate rights to Pakistan, to Kashmir ever. They've occupied part of Kashmir. And most of their fights with India have all been about this little bit of territory. It's a territory which doesn't grow very much apart from hashish and other things, which are perhaps, you know, opium and things like that, which aren't perhaps the best things to export. And a lot of the animosity between Pakistan and India would go if the issue with Kashmir would go. But basically, Pakistan is like a dog in the manger. It must have what it wants, even though it's going to gain very little by it. It's another of these things where what's called a waqf in Islam is an endowment. For example, if you look at Israel and the Palestinian so-called territories, the idea in the Hamas Charter, it states very, very clearly that Jerusalem and the land occupied by the Jews is a waqf. A waqf, W-A-Q-F, it means an endowment. And in terms of it, that would mean in terms of inheritance and land, you know, after a divorce. But it also means if a Muslim land has once been occupied by Islam, forever and a day, it must always be Islamic. This is the problem of when people allow mosques to be built. Once you allow a mosque to be built in the West, according to the more fundamentalist Muslims, that is a waqf. That is Islamic territory. It's an endowment from Allah given to Muslims for them to forever have that as their territory. For that reason, Hamas will never, ever concede anything to Israel or to having Jews within what they regard as their WACF, their endowment. And Kashmir is another case in point where Pakistan, even though it has never been officially given Kashmir, it believes that because Kashmir has a lot of Muslims, therefore it must be Muslim and therefore not run by a secular nation like India. It really has, the whole Kashmir issue has no sense behind it, and it has created movements. Jaish-e-Mohammed and Lashkar-e-Taiba, and more recently Jamaat-ud-Dawah, are Islamic groups which have been set up specifically with the intention and the encouragement, with a nod from Pakistani governments and in particular the military and the ISI, in order to create terrorism against India. And Pakistan is now saying that it's going to be fighting, it really wants to be working with America on fighting key terrorist groups. Well, that's fine in theory. In practice, don't believe it. I don't think there's anything that the Pakistani government can say now to retrieve any credibility. It is, in my opinion, the only reason why Pakistan should be appeased is so that troops can get supplies in and out, up the Khyber Pass and into Afghanistan, until that moment when finally the troops are all withdrawn from Afghanistan. And after that point, whether Pakistan is regarded as an ally or not is really up for bargaining. We have another problem in the world. We have Somalia. We have Somalia is engaged, the Horn of Africa is engaged at the current time in a massive famine. And now we have stories coming out that the Islamists in Somalia, who are the Al-Shabaab group, who are tied up with Al-Qaeda, they are saying that there is no famine. And they are, first last week they were saying yes, they were going to allow Western aid agencies in to bring food and supplies. And now there are stories coming out from neighboring nations like Kenya, where refugees have been saying that the Islamists have prevented them from escaping. That they have, you know, tried to hinder them because basically they're in denial. It's also Amnesty International and other groups have then been castigating everybody, saying that most nations haven't been giving money to this famine. And human famines are appalling things. But the danger is when you have a country which is run effectively by a government, Sharif, who runs the transitional government, he was one of the people before who was setting up Islamist courts and having people executed by firing squad under Sharia law. But he's actually now lost a lot of his popularity with the people. The official government of Somalia is it's a failed state. And now you have the rule of law on the ground is being enacted mostly by Islamists. The problem of bringing money and supplies in is that you're probably going to be helping to feed and clothe and give a lot of sustenance to these Islamist groups, which is probably why so many people aren't that bothered about giving aid money to Somalia, which is a horrible truth, but it is there. Famines are terrible, but it's like what happened with Ethiopia. All that famous thing of feed the world, and back in 1985, the government of Haile Mengistu, who was in charge of Ethiopia at that time, he was importing alcohol and food for himself and his government. They were just not distributing it. There was a big crisis going on, and the world responded with aid to Ethiopia, but the corrupt communist government that was in charge at that time was spending money which was intended for aid on itself. It is always a problem when famines go on, but when you have Islamists involved, it makes it worse. Now, on to the issue today of what was going on in Norway. I was asked by my boss at Family Security Matters to write an article, and I hummed and hawed and said, well, I'm preparing for my show. I will get something up on the site by tomorrow. News, when you have a breaking news story like this, it changes all the time, and it is continuing to change. Therefore, I know if I was to write one article, I would then be having to go back all over the weekend to change things because the news would be changing. For example, at 5 hours ago, the news was that there had been a bomb in the center of Oslo, in one of the government offices, at which two people had been killed and about 15 had been injured. Then shortly after that, news came that on an island just south of Oslo, where the Labour Party, which is the party in power in Oslo, had been having a youth rally when a gunman started to fire, and they thought a few people were injured. The figure went up from two people being killed. It went up to seven. Then it went up to about seven people were being killed, had been killed in Oslo town centre by this massive car bomb. And then news came that there are stories of at least 20 bodies have been seen on the island in just south of Oslo. News came after that that a man has been arrested, and they're saying he's Norwegian. Now, he was a man dressed as a policeman who started to fire on the youth who were having this annual rally, a political rally on this island. And because he's now being said to be Norwegian and blonde-haired, they're now assuming that he isn't even Muslim, which was what was thrown into the mix before. Some groups like The Guardian, very left-wing British newspaper, was saying that Islamists were involved. The Sydney Morning Herald was saying the same thing. The Australian newspaper, that Islamists were involved. That was the general supposition. And now, because the man happens to be blonde, all of a sudden, Islam isn't involved. Unless they've got direct information from this character, we can't really say that Islam is or isn't involved. What happened about converts? It's always the most...
Yeah.
The people who get through the networks are converts. Did you just use a bad word?
No, I said yeah, because you were saying what I've been thinking.
Well, I think he's a convert, and I'm pretty certain. Now, we have one caller on the switchboard, I believe. Can you see there's a caller?
Yeah, that's me.
That's you, is it? Oh, sorry. Right,
okay.
That's fine. Right. Now, this is just a very problematic issue. That, you know, this is breaking news. I don't want to go into... I mean, I want to talk about the Islamist situation in Oslo. I like to provide facts. I don't want to provide speculation. And while there is still speculation, it is highly likely that the killer would be an Islamist. Now, the reasons for this... Norway isn't an imperial nation. When we had the IRA in Britain, for example, they were trying to fight for their independence from colonial Britain. And even though they used horrific methods, people could more or less see why they were doing what they were doing, even though it was totally unjustifiable. Norway does not have that. Now, Norway has a handful of soldiers by comparison to other nations. It has some soldiers in the coalition in Afghanistan. Now, the main reason why people are complaining about this or suggesting that there's Islamism has been involved is to do with the issue of the cartoons in Norway. Now, back in 2006, in February, they had had it's actually earlier than that. In Norway, in the beginning of January, the weekly journal called Magazinet had published the 12 cartoons, the Danish cartoons, which had originally been published by Jyllands Posten. Now, Jyllands Posten had, on the 30th of September 2005, printed 12 pictures of Muhammad, the founder of Islam, and that was regarded as highly insulting, and a man called Abu Laban and Ahmed Akiri, his sidekick, had gone around disseminating information about this to the Muslim world, to Al-Azhar University, Yusuf Al-Qaradawi, and other influential Islamists, so that eventually by February there was a massive furore. But in January of 2006, before the world exploded into violence, in which more than 50 people died and many more were injured, this weekly journal in Norway called Magazinet had republished all of the cartoons. Then in February, after there had been an outcry around the world and people started to get killed, at the beginning of February, there were riots in Pakistan, and an 8-year-old boy died, and a few adults died. Then the biggest rioting actually took place in Nigeria, where about 20 to 25 people died. But there were sporadic acts of violence all around the place. Now, Norway in Syria at that time in February, the Norwegian embassy was burned down in February. And so at the end of January, the Norwegian Foreign Ministry apologized to the inverted commas Muslim world, whatever that is, for the publication by Magazinet. And Vebjørn Selbekk, now he's the editor of Magazinet at that time, he met with Muslim representatives from the Islamic Council of Norway, and this is his actual words from my notes here. "I personally address the Muslim community to say that I am sorry that your religious feelings are offended by what we did on January the 10th when Magazinet published a facsimile of the Danish drawings from Jyllands Posten. It was never our intention to hurt anyone." And then the people he was talking to, there was a man called Mohammed Hamdan who said that the Quran preached forgiveness. Well, there's been no forgiveness for Norway, because in July last year, we had three people were arrested in Norway who were said to be still plotting to get their revenge for the cartoons. There were three men. One was a Uyghur. They're a group that live in the western part of China. The Uyghur have almost, they don't look very Chinese for the most part. Genetically, they're a mixture of Chinese and Central Asian peoples. And, you know, there used to be a language called Tocharian, which is an Indo-European language, which was spoken by people. And in Urumqi, there are these mummies which have brown hair, and they show a lot of links with European and Central Asian peoples. So this region where the Uyghurs, spelt U-I-G-H-I-R-S, where they live, a Uyghur was arrested in Norway, an Iraqi and an Uzbek from Uzbekistan. Again, that's in Central Asia. These three individuals, they are still in prison, they're awaiting trial. And these people are awaiting trial for plotting to go to Denmark, which isn't that far away, small boat ride, to attack Jyllands Posten. But whether they were going to attack there or if they were going to attack in Norway, it's not true. But it was certainly they were arrested because of plots to get revenge for the cartoons. Whether their revenge was going to be directly on Jyllands Posten, of which there were also other people arrested. There was a man he was a one-legged Chechen boxer who was arrested after he got to Copenhagen, which is in Denmark, on his way to the Yarlens Post and offices, and he had, in his hotel room, had been trying to make a letter bomb, and he managed to blow himself up while on the toilet and then injure himself, and then he was arrested in a park outside. So there seems to be a linked group. Now, Afghanistan does also seem to feature with these. Now, when these people were arrested in July, these three Norwegians, at the same time, there was a man in... he'd been arrested in Afghanistan, and he was coming out with information about attacks which were going to be happening in... which were planned to happen in France, in Germany, Britain, and also America. So everybody was on very, very high alert about exactly a year ago. And it seems potentially that this is still carrying on. Now, I don't even know how long we've been on air for now because I have my windows shut. Okay, we've been on air for about 26 minutes with me droning on, and I still haven't got into the nitty-gritty and the details of what's been going on in Oslo. Now, I'm going to have a little break and for a couple of minutes so I can just get myself some tea, have a comfort break, and I will also drop into the... I will drop into the chat room to see if there's anybody there. Okay, this is a very short break, and this is from a jug band. I quite like jug bands, but have a little listen to this.
Mama, don't you tell on me. I'm stealing back to my same old used to be. Now put your arms around me like the circle around the sun. I want you to love me, Mama, like my easy ride I done. If you don't believe I love you, look what a fool I've been. If you don't believe I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in. Stealing, stealing, put it, Mama, don't you tell on me. I'm stealing back to my same old used to be. I'm stealing, stealing, pretty mama, don't you tell on me. I'm stealing back to my same old used to be. A woman I'm loving, she's just my height and size. She's a married woman, come to see me sometime. If you don't believe I love you, look what a fool I've been. If you don't believe I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in. I'm stealing, stealing, put it, Mama, don't you tell on me. I'm stealing back to my same old used to be. I'm stealing, stealing, put it, Mama, don't you tell on me. I'm stealing back to my same old used to be. Pretty mama, don't you tell on me. I'm stealing back to my same old used to be.
Okay, I've just got back. Now, yeah, this whole business of what's going on in Norway, it's really, at the moment, it's very hard for me to say that it's exactly caused by anything particular. Let me just run through with you on the timeline of what actually happened this afternoon. Now, the island where the people were shot is called Utøya. It's just south, and it's a very, very small island. Now, the first bomb goes off at 2:36 p.m., and that's local time for them. And Jens Stoltenberg, like the country's prime minister, rumors at first thought that he was caught up in the blast, but he apparently wasn't. He wasn't in his office then. And at 3:40, shortly after that, then there's reports of more blasts happening. Whether they actually happened or not is unknown. People were being told to go home as fast as possible to avoid the center of Oslo. 3:46, the first confirmations of a powerful explosion taking place came out. And then at that time, they were knowing that at least one person had died. Shortly after that, that rose to two. 5:10 p.m., which is, you know, about 6 hours, 6 hours, 20 minutes ago, the emergency services in Oslo were saying that 15 people had been injured. And the devastation in the photographs, it's quite horrific. I mean, I remember I was in London when they had the Baltic Exchange bombing, which is one of the biggest blasts ever in London. I was 2.5 miles away, and it sounded as if a lorry had dropped a whole load of scaffolding onto the floor outside. And when I went 2 days later through the city of London, almost every single building, one building had been entirely blown to pieces, but every single building, it seemed, in the city had all of its windows blown out. And it was very much similar. So it's a massive blast. The blast which happened, it was an IRA bomb when they had the Baltic Exchange bomb, the one that I heard from my apartment in North London. That was a truck that was full of explosives, and two people died in the explosion. You know, a night watchman. This happened late in the evening on a Friday night. Now, this what happened in Oslo? Car bomb was in broad daylight, so you know it was probably hoping to get people who were traveling around shopping. Now, the theories at the present time, and I'm saying these are only theories, what is coming out, this is from the BBC, which is notoriously left-wing, which is notoriously pro-multiculturalism, and doesn't like to use the terms Islamism and terrorism in the same sentence, unless it really has to. Is suggesting that this is a blonde individual who had dressed up as a policeman in the island. And obviously it seems that the two events are connected. However, car bombs can be set with timers. So they are suggesting, and I'm saying this is only a suggestion, I'm going to make my next break in about 20 minutes or 25 minutes, a little bit longer, so I can just check up on news. And if anybody in the chat room does get any updated news, please pass on a link, and I will present it here on the show. But they are suggesting that it could be just one disgruntled individual with a political grievance. Now, personally, I think that's really very, very hard to take seriously. It's also very hard to take seriously. If I was to be saying 15 years ago or 10 years ago that somebody would want to murder so many people all because of a damned cartoon, I would have been regarded as an idiot. But then again, it happened. You know, when they had the issue of the Salman Rushdie affair, February 14th, 1989, Ayatollah Khomeini announced that because of writing the satanic verses that Ayatollah Khomeini should be killed. And in India, there was a library was destroyed. People did end up being stabbed, translators. The Japanese translator was stabbed to death. I think it was the Italian translator was stabbed in a lift and he survived. He was only injured. But, you know, the fact that people are prepared to kill because of an insult is a really sickening, sickening thing. So, at the moment, until evidence comes out, I mean, they have in custody, alive, the man who had been doing the shooting on this Chitoya Island. So, theoretically, they will know more soon. Now, Norway isn't like other European countries. Most of the countries of Europe are part of the European Union. Now, Norway isn't. Norway, like almost every other European country, is a member of the Council of Europe, but it is not a member of the European Union. So Norway has absolutely no need to engage with the multiculturalism which is being forced by law throughout Europe. But like Switzerland, the other major European country which is not part of the European Union, for some reason, multiculturalism and political correctness is the order of the day, and it rules. And even though they recently had the issue of a couple of years ago, they were trying to stop the construction of minarets in Switzerland. Apparently, one of the people who was... you have to get so many votes in Switzerland to get people to change the law, to have a referendum. And one of the guys who'd been doing this thing of trying to get people to sign signatures saying they don't want any minarets built in Switzerland apparently has now become a Muslim. Irony of ironies. And Norway has a massive amount of Pakistanis and Somalis. It has opened its door to people from all around the world, and what that has brought with it has unfortunately been a load of problems. And, you know, without being too sort of horrible, it's, you know, there's this case of, you know, in one of these, the people in charge of Norway are the Labour Party at the moment. They've been in charge for quite a long time. There is a mosque which is in that region, and it's full of Pakistanis, but it's has been receiving state funding. I mean, unlike over here in America and Britain, you know, mosques generally are expected to be paying for themselves. But this one particular mosque, it's called the Markazi Jamaat Ahle Sunnat. It's Pakistani owned. And in 1 year, in 2005, in state funding, it received $211,000 just to keep itself running. And then there was a massive fight. There was an argument about who was going to become the head of this mosque. People were hitting each other with iron bars. People got hospitalized. 6 people were arrested. And then, it's in the Grønland region of Oslo. This is going back to like 2006, March the 3rd, now when this sort of fighting was happening. And the imam of the congregation, a man called Malik Muhammad Raza, he was attacked and he was injured. But then it turns out that another man called Khalid Mahmoud, who was involved with the fighting and he'd been arrested, He was a local politician tied up with the Labour Party, the same people who are in power now. So, really, what Norway has opened its doors for, with they've had honour killings, they've got several cases of people being taken back to, they've been taken back to Somalia to go and have female genital mutilation. You have a large Pakistani community, of which this Markazi Jamaat al-Sunnat Mosque. Now, with the name, the Markazi Jamaat al-Sunnat, it sounds very, very similar to the group which runs the Green Lane Mosque in Britain, you know, of which, you know, a lot of the people involved in that, some they're connected with Saudi Arabia, but it's Deobandi, and yeah, like the Taliban were all Deobandi who believed that after the age of 8, women shouldn't be educated, girls shouldn't be educated. And unfortunately, this is extremism, and this is extremism which is being funded by the state, and this is what Norway has become. You know, it has no reason to be so politically correct. And then you've got other people, I mean, sort of fun characters, like the World Islamic Mission. It's a mosque and cultural centre, again, in Oslo. And it's, again, in the Grønland district, which is, you know, near where the other mosque is. And its leading figure is a man called Syed Ikram Jilani, who has publicly stated, following the Quran, Surah 434, that it's perfectly acceptable for a man to beat his wife to show the husband's anger. And he says that this should be carried out under special circumstances, such as when the wife has been unfaithful. And he says, just a few blows to the body, they're sufficient. These are the sort of morons who are being given funding. They are being given legitimization by this Labour government in Norway. So it's actually very strange if Norway's government should be attacked by Muslims, considering how it's giving out so much to Muslims in the country. There were just recently, there were plans last year to have the highest mosque in the world in terms of latitude. Now, there's a place called Tromsø in the very north of Norway. Now, this was a place where they used to believe on Valpurgis night in the spring that all the witches and the would all go to Tromsø and gather in the church there. And, you know, where there's the one of the highest churches, you know, in terms of latitude, closest to the North Pole. Last year, they planned to build this highest mosque in the world. It all collapsed because it then turned out that all the money was coming from Saudis. And by that time, the Labour government had realised that funding mosques from abroad would also mean that you were going to end up with imams who would be promoting stuff like wife beating and all the other things for which traditional Wahhabi Islam is renowned for: intolerance of the West, not liking Jews, treating women as second-class citizens. And so when they were expecting the people to build this mosque, expected there to be funding from the government and the rest to be funded by a businessman who was taking money directly from the Saudi government. When that was discovered, that stopped. Now, the other aspect of Norway, which I think is also very important to mention, is a man called Mullah Krekar. Now, Mullah Krekar has been in the news on and off for a long time, but he's gone off the radar recently. He hasn't featured very much. Now, Mullah Krekar is an Iraqi Kurd. Now, he had originally come to Norway in the late, well, sort of middle to late 1990s. He had been, actually, no, earlier than that, because he'd been in 2006. He had been there for 14 years, so it would have been 1992 he must have arrived, so it's probably nearly 19 years now, that Mulla Krekar had been, he'd arrived in Norway claiming that he was an Iraqi Kurd. He was being oppressed by the nasty Saddam Hussein regime. And then once he had got himself established as an asylum seeker, he then started to preach for jihad. And following the 9/11 attacks, he then went out. I think in 2002, he went back to Iraq and he set up a group called Ansar al-Islam. And Ansar al-Islam, which means Army of Islam, basically, then started to carry out attacks on beauticians, hairdressers. Women were attacked and killed in the streets for not wearing burqas. And then he would come back to Norway and still carry on claiming his benefits as an asylum seeker. You know, basically, he made about three or four different visits, even though the whole conditions in which he had said that he had become a refugee, an asylum seeker within Norway, was that he said that his life would be in danger if he went back to Iraq. So he went back to Iraq on several occasions, set up a group which started fighting with other Muslim groups, started attacking and killing people who were not Orthodox Islamic. And then comes back and says, you know, oh, I can't go back to Iraq because, you know, they might kill me. This is the takir, the duplicity. And then while he was in Norway, he would go on air and broadcast about how wonderful Osama bin Laden is, you know. And basically, even though the Norwegians, they signed in 1950, along with Russia, which is also a member of the Council of Europe, the European Convention on Human Rights. This Convention on Human Rights states that, you know, you can't send somebody back to a country where they might be tortured. At that time when this was signed, Stalin was in power. He didn't give a monkey's left testicle what happened to people who would, you know, come as refugees. He signed it. I mean, he was quite happy to send people off to the gulags up in Siberia to die. Norway is one of the few countries which doesn't need other countries to bully it. It follows the terms of the ECHR, as it's called, this 1950s document signed by the Council of Europe, for which it belongs. It follows those to the letter. Britain has now got itself into real problems over this same document, because it signed this document in 1950, but still allowed people to be sent back to countries if they were believed to be terrorists, or they were trying to incite terrorism or dissent or disruption in Britain. And in 1998, a year after the wonderful Tony Blair came into power, Labour, socialist, he introduced the Human Rights Act, which meant that every law in Britain should be subservient to the 1950 Council of Europe, European Convention of Human Rights. And this EHCR document now means that we have got Afghanistani terrorists who hijacked planes are now given rights to remain in the country, you know, indefinitely, on benefits, with their wives and their little brats, all paid for by British taxpayers. And it's made a mockery. We've had people like Abu Qatada, who was described by a Spanish judge as being Al-Qaeda's ambassador in Europe. Two of the members of the Hamburg cell, who then went on to be in the planes, which one of them was on a plane which hit the World Trade Center. The other one was on a plane which ditched itself in Shanksville. And one was brought down, Flight 93. these two individuals from the Hamburg cell who took part in the 9/11 attacks both had the sermons of Abu Qatada on their cassette players. This individual, we cannot get rid of him from Britain because of this ridiculous legitimization of this law. It's all very well to sign in 1950 a document. It is only a country as politically correct and so full of its own self-righteousness as Norway is to decide that it's going to make sure that someone like Mullah Krekar will always have his rights protected. Most of the people in Norway would happily see Mullah Krekar sent back to Kurdish Iraq and to let the local people deal with him there. Even though they have made statements, there's been statements that living in Kurdish Iraq now that there's apparently some sort of peace, would for most people mean that if you're a Kurd, you're not under threat. There was the time with Halabja when Saddam Hussein was using chemical warfare against the individuals in that country. Now it's not the same. You've got a government, al-Maliki in charge, who's he's actually really a stooge for Iran. He's a Shiite, but basically someone like Mullah Krekar might be killed because of the people that he's killed, in vengeance for what he has done. But this is the problem. When you have asylum seekers who come to the West, they claim asylum. It's like Abu Qatada when he came to Britain, this so-called ambassador for Al-Qaeda in Europe, according to Baltasar Garzon, this Spanish judge. When he had come to Britain, he had come to Britain with a false passport. He had a whole load of money as well, which... he had come under false means, and he'd been chucked out. But no, he was allowed to stay, and then he started preaching jihad, then he was put under house arrest, under what's called a control order, then he went and challenged his control order, and then he was let out, then he was seen punching a journalist, and eventually now he's actually back in jail again. We've got another man called Yasser al-Siri. We have a whole load of people who come to European countries claiming asylum, and then while in their so-called claiming asylum, they plot terror and vengeance elsewhere. Yasser al-Siri has been convicted in Egypt of trying to assassinate Hosni Mubarak. A six-year-old girl died in this attack, which he has been found guilty of being instigating. We have a man who runs Islam TV from Britain, and that is another individual who in Tunisia was convicted on terrorism charges. For a while he was on a red list on an Interpol watch list. We have these terribly awful dilemmas of trying to be nice to people, knowing that they are then going to go back to countries and incite hate, if not murder. I don't want to say that the head of Islam TV incites murder, because I could get sued for saying it. So whatever it is that has happened in Oslo today, if there is one lone individual, he must have an awful lot of hate. He must have a massive vengeance against the whole state of Norway for him to kill 20 people at the end of a gun and to have the wherewithal and the brain power to set off a car bomb in advance of his attacks and to dress up as a policeman. For one individual to go that far, he must be very committed. This isn't the act of a lunatic like Jared Loughner, with Giffords. I've forgotten the first name, but this isn't a lunatic who's gone off the rails. This is somebody who obviously planned ahead, probably as part of a group. But then we're getting into the region of suppositions. Now, while I'm saying that, it's been about 20 seconds. I'm going to have, again, a very short break. Unless anybody wants to call in. Now, please, anyone in the chat room, if you want to call in, please do. I know Gary's in there. I know Gary's got a lot of things to say. One thing I want to discuss in the second half of the show, I want to discuss Al-Qaeda's publications. I mean, it's a little bit boring. I must admit. I mean, they had their summer edition came out very recently, and it is full of emotive. It's actually incredibly funny if you're prepared to look at it objectively. And what is interesting, and Gary Johnson, I don't know if he's still there in the chat room, but he did point out that in the when I sent him a link to where this thing could be found, he was saying that it's very interesting. They have a picture of the Sydney Opera House, and it's just, is that a message? Is it not? I don't know. In the, this is issue 6, their summer edition. In issue 5, I looked at the same section, and it had a picture of the Chrysler building in New York. Beautiful building. And then, which is actually now owned by, majority of it is owned by Saudis. And there is also Amnesty. This is another piece of news as well. I forgot to mention. Amnesty International are now having a go at Saudi Arabia. Recently, this week, Saudi Arabia leaked information that it was going to have, it had Al-Qaeda people were trying to then bring the jihad operations back to Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia has had numerous groups of people that it has killed, you know, in the name of jihad. I remember in 2005 when I first started blogging about Islamism, they had, at that time, they had a hit list of 150 people, and they were just killing off the last few people, and they didn't bother to give these people trials or anything, they just assassinated them. And they leaked this document this week, which was saying to their own local media that Al-Qaeda's planning to regroup and to focus itself on Riyadh. It's like they were trying to up the ante, get the pressure up so people are getting all paranoid again to justify acts against people that they don't like. Now, I don't have any time for Amnesty International. Some of the things it does are good, but for the majority of its time, it is run by leftist morons who justify the unjustifiable. They support many Islamist groups and individuals, people like Muazzam Beg, who was a Guantanamo inmate. They often support his website, Caged Prisoners, with a lot of what he has on there. It's just hysterical, highly unobjective, pro-Islamist, anti-Western crap, basically, if I can say crap. If I can't, I'm very sorry. Now, Amnesty International have now criticized Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia has now come up with its new anti-terror document, and its anti-terror legislation now means that you cannot criticize the state or the legitimacy of the Al Saud family as being the legitimate rulers of Saudi Arabia. Ever since they had the Khobar Towers incident back in 1998, where quite a few Americans died, where Al-Qaeda did a massive attack in, I think it was 1990, it was in the 1990s, and it was before 2000, it was before the two big bombings of 1998 August, when you had Tanzania and Kenya, you had the two American embassies attacked. And it was, you know, long before the 9/11 attack. But Khobar Towers was a part of Saudi Arabia, tied up with the oil trade, where there were several Americans were there, and it was blown up with, you know, several casualties and deaths. And that was the biggest strike that Al-Qaeda had made on Saudi territory. But now, what the Saudi government is doing is trying to say that if you criticize the Saudi government, then you're basically a terrorist and you can be treated as a terrorist. Now, in a country where a pharmacist at the end of 2007 was decapitated publicly for being involved in witchcraft, you can't expect that there's going to be fair trials for people. And this is where the, you know, in that aspect, I agree with Amnesty International, because you cannot have an anti-terror law that doesn't allow people to have freedom of speech. You know, in a country like Saudi Arabia, where there is no freedom for anybody unless they are part of the Saudi royal family. And let's not forget what happened in 2004 when you had the horrific incident in March 2004. There was a fire, took place at a girl's dormitory. Now, they have these people called the Mutawa. Now, these Mutawa are the religious police, the enforcers of the group, which is for the preservation of, I've got to get this right, the preservation of virtue and prohibition of vice. I always get it wrong, you know. I always think about it as the preservation of vice and the prohibition of virtue, but that's my own bizarre. Now, these people, they wear these red tea towel keftiyehs, you know, with the little tea towel patterns on their heads. These people are the religious police. A fire broke out in a girl's dormitory near Mecca, and the girls ran to try and escape from this burning building. And what happened was the religious police were outside and they saw these girls were coming out without head coverings on. They weren't dressed modestly enough. And so they forced them back into this burning building and at least 15 girls died. And they wouldn't let the firemen get anywhere near them and rescue them because these girls were not dressed properly. This is the sort of corrupt... I have no time for Saudi Arabia. I refuse to accept it as a legitimate nation. It came into being in 1932, Abdulaziz. I mean, as a British person, I've got to say I feel slightly responsible for my country's activities in putting such a despot into power. And if Abdulaziz had not come into power, the situation with Saudi Arabia would have been very, very different. And in fact, until 1979, Saudi Arabia had actually been quite a lot more tolerant than it is now. In 1979, you had a plan to destroy Mecca, and an uncle of Osama bin Laden was amongst the people who were there. Now, the bin Laden family in Saudi Arabia, they are involved with the construction industry. At present, they've been building a massive thing called the Zamzam Tower, named after a sacred well, which towers over the Grand Mosque of Mecca. And this thing with the construction industry, the uncle of Osama bin Laden was one of the people who had then tried to take over the Kaaba, the sacred stone in the square box in the middle of Mecca. And these people had, with knowledge of the tunnels, now at that time the bin Laden family, the construction industry, were working on the building of the tunnels in 1979. And this uncle, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he had been involved in this plot. One of the men, they believed there was a new Mahdi. This has always been in times of crisis. I will talk anthropologically just for a brief minute. When you have times of crisis, you always get messianic cults arrives. Islands of New Guinea in the Second World War, after people had had witness of the Japanese coming there and then the Americans and Australians bringing cargo, what were called cargo cults evolved. where they believed that a messianic figure called John Frum would come and save them. Winston Churchill, in the 1890s, he fought at the Battle of Omdurman. The Battle of Omdurman in Sudan was all as the result of another man who claimed he was the Mahdi. The Mahdi for Muslims will be like the second coming. He will be an incarnation. In the Hadith, the Mahdi is said he comes from the line of the Prophet via his daughter Fatima. Fatima married Ali, who was his cousin, Ali ibn Talib. Ali was the fourth caliph in Sunni Islam. He was the first caliph of the Shia Islamists, and it was the murder of Ali, followed by the murder of his of Hussein, his son, which then led to the shift between Shia and Sunnis. Now, I'm going way, way, way off course here, but the Mahdi is believed to have come from that line of descent, of which every descendant of the Prophet is basically has to come through the line of Fatima anyway. Now, you have got people in Indonesia. People who claim to be descendants of the Prophet are seen as the Mahdi. There is one character who is regarded as the Mahdi. He's very, very old now. I think he actually lives in Malaysia now, but there is another character who heads the thing called the Front Pembela Islam, or the Islamic Defenders Front. They are very active in killing and persecuting Christians. And this man, he claims that he is a descendant of the Prophet. And if you claim that you're a descendant of the Prophet, not only do you get this cachet of being connected in some way to the Prophet Muhammad, you also have this possibility that you could be the Mahdi. You could be the Messiah figure. The whole reason why Iran at the current moment in time is believing that it can build nuclear weapons and plunge the world into chaos is again because of this idea of the Mahdi. The Mahdi is somebody who will rise up. According to the Shias, the Mahdi for them was their 12th Imam, who in the 8th century, I think it was 840 or so, he was 5 years old and he disappeared. He was the 12th Imam. The first Imam was Ali, and then he was the 12th generation after Ali, the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. And again, he was a descendant directly of Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad. And the 12th Imam disappeared from view. Apparently, he hovered around the earth for 100 years in what was called a minor occultation, and then he went into what's called a grand occultation. In the 50s, there was a group called the Hojatiyeh Society, which came out, and they have people like Ayatollah Mezbayazdi. He's the main exponent. He used to be a friend of Ayatollah Khomeini. And then in about 1983, Ayatollah Khomeini sort of fell out with him. But the idea is that the Mahdi will come back, and you can make the Mahdi come back, the 12th Imam come back to Earth by creating chaos. Now, Ayatollah Mezbayazdi, he was the man who gave a fatwa urging people to vote for the Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is the current Prime Minister, President, I believe, I'm not sure if it's President or Prime, or he's still not the Supreme Leader, who's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, but Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he's a secular leader, but he had a fatwa issued in June of 2005, which then led to him becoming told that said, you must vote for him because he's the only true Islamic candidate. Ahmadinejad had been he'd been actually studied traffic management when he was at university, and he had been the mayor of Tehran. He became prime minister or president, and then straight away got into, within a month after he came to power, he was talking about wiping Israel off the map. Currently in Iran, the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, is believed to live down a well in the holy city of Qom. And this is the Shia belief in the Mahdi, this is I'm talking about. And people drop letters to him, like kids write to Santa Claus at the North Pole. People drop letters down this well in the hope that Imam Mahdi, who's currently in his grand occultation, he, you know, will then read the letters and make things come true. Also, according to Amir Tahiri, there's this belief in 12er Shia Islam that at every moment in time, there will always be 36 individuals who are what are called the Awtad, O-W-T-A-D, which are nails. Now, these nails are human individuals whose souls are so strong, they nail the universe in place, of which the belief is that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, to his followers, or to the people that he was trying to convince that he's so wonderful, he is one of these outads, these nails which hold the world in its place until the time that the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, can come back. Okay, I've diverged a bit, but anyway, back to 1979. I was talking about the Osama bin Laden family and how an uncle of Osama bin Laden was involved in the 1979 attempt to take over. About 150 people at least were beheaded. The only one of the, including this man who believed he was going to be the Mahdi. And when that happened, the only one who wasn't executed was the uncle of Osama bin Laden, who still apparently sits in on meetings, but his family have agreed that he must not have any say in votes or decision makings within the company. He still gets a nice, healthy income from being part of the construction industry set up by the bin Ladens. But after that attempt in 1979 to overtake the Kaaba at Mecca, from that time on, the Saudi society has been extremely rigid. It was rigid before, but it has worsened since 1979, and it's continued in that same vein. And now, with this aging King Abdullah, the latest anti-terror legislation is just another excuse for the corrupt House of Saud. The House of Saud, which is quite happy in 2006, there was a 70-year-old disabled woman had gone into a shop on her own where there was a single male shopkeeper. As a result, the Mutawa, the religious police, carted her off. Her son was looking for her. He'd gone shopping with her, and the old lady had decided to hobble into a shop to go and see if she could buy something as a little treat. He finally found her in a jail at the end of, after a couple of days of searching, because she had been found guilty of the crime of Khalwat. Khalwat, K-H-A-L-W-A-T, is the crime of being in close proximity to somebody who is not a legitimate relative. A woman and a man who aren't married, who aren't brother or sister, who aren't part of a family, cannot be in close proximity, otherwise they'll end up in jail. And now, obviously, the 70-year-old disabled woman, being a woman, was the one who was carted off to jail. The shopkeeper, because he didn't chase her out with a stick, he should also have been put in jail if Khalwat was really taken seriously. But it always seems, in Malaysia as well, you have, in certain states, you have Khalwat is a very serious offence. And you can't have men and women in Kota Bari, for example, in Malaysia. You can't have them in shops in the same queue. You have to have one aisle for men, one aisle for women. Saudi Arabia also had a case not so long back. I don't know if you remember, there was a case of a Saudi Shia girl who was with her boyfriend in a car. They were abducted, taken by a gang to a house out in the desert, and she was raped multiple times. And she and these people filmed it with their mobile phones. And then she was given 150 lashes sentence because she had been with her boyfriend in a car who wasn't a relative, and she had committed the crime of Khalwat. I mean, this is the corrupt nastiness which is at the heart of Saudi Arabia. There is no compassion. The fact that you can allow girls running out of a building on, from flames and from smoke and fire, and to push them back in there knowing they'll be burned to death because they don't conform to a dress code. This is what is the insanity of Islam taken to its logical conclusion. You know, where the rule of law supersedes the rule of nature, the rule of common sense, where humanity does not come into decisions. It's like, you have sinned, you must die, which is where the honor culture comes in, where your daughter doesn't conform, you kill her. In Jordan, until very recently, if you killed one of your relatives because she had not lived up to the standards that you expected, you could get time off. Same thing in Turkey. In Turkey, they could happily, and it used to happen a lot in the Kurdish regions in the east, Dubakir and other regions around Lake Van, and Van, the town in there, in the east of Turkey, where there's a high Kurdish population, where they hadn't gone along with the modernization which had hit the rest of Turkey, you have this thing of, until 2004-05, you had been allowed to murder a relative and then get to not even have to go to jail, because you were killing for honor. You were protecting your family honor. A lot of the cases of honor killings in Europe, which is just, one day, I think, very soon, I will make an issue all about honor killings, because it's something that I think is very, very important. But a lot of the cases in Germany and Denmark, for example, of honor killings all come from Turkish migrants who really cannot see anything that wrong with it. But in Turkish law, until they try to join the European Union, where any killing is regarded as a killing, you get no special dispensation for honour. Until that time, you could get off virtually scot-free. If you went to jail, it would be for a token 6 months or so for killing your sister or your daughter. Quite sick. Everyone says, if you talk to Muslims about it, oh, this is not Islamic. If it's not Islamic, why does it exist in Pakistan, in Jordan, in Turkey, in Egypt, and so many other Muslim cultures which aren't anthropologically from the same group? But still, I'm digressing, and I think it's time that I shut up, give my vocal cords, my tea is going cold. I'm going to play some nice music. I didn't have my little break as I said I was going to do. Let's play something that I haven't played for a while. A little bit of music. And please, if anyone wants to call in, please do. I'm always open to... Oh, I like this one. It's a nice bit of music. By the Heptones. With Leroy Sibbles doing the vocals. Book of Rules, if I can get it to play, which I can't.
Isn't it strange, oh, since it is
Come to an end now. Now, I said I was going to be dealing with the... last week, I made a couple of mistakes. I've got to first and foremost admit to those. I mentioned Marian Davidson when I should have said Marian Anderson, and thank you to Freedom's Wings, who's not here at the moment, for pointing that out to me. And the week before that, I also made another mistake. I mentioned that the people of who carried out the 7/7 bombings were driving a Ford Nissan Micra. You either have a Ford car or a Nissan car. It was a Nissan Micra. My mistake. I just thought I'd better clear up those bits. And also I made a mistake about Hakim A. Ahmed. It's Hakim A. Jamal. His real name was Alan Donaldson, as I said, but this is what happens when I don't use my notes. I should actually prepare everything, script it all out, and talk from the... a script, I think. And talking of scripts, this week, it actually came out on July the 6th, the 6th edition of Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine. And at the very beginning, it acknowledges, and this is something quite interesting, that it acknowledges that they have been attacked very badly. They have lost some of their main... jihadists. Now, the Inspire magazine, it's produced by AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. It's produced in Yemen, and there have only been a couple of drone strikes by Americans in that region, and basically, in the first of these drone strikes, a lot of two people got killed who were meant to have been quite close to Anwar al-Awlaki. And then there's been another drone strike, and there's been attacks by gunfire. Now, at the very beginning, there's an apology in this week's edition, or this month's edition. Now, let me just read out this. Just to let you know that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this is where Anwar al-Awlaki, he used to be the imam of the Falls Church Mosque in the Dar al-Hijra Mosque in Falls Church in Virginia. He said, we apologize. Now, this is the very beginning, first page of the Al-Qaeda magazine. We apologize for the delay in the publication of the magazine. Things have been quite hectic over here. The country is falling apart, and our brothers are busy picking up the pieces. It's like walking into an orchard of ripe fruit that is falling off the branches, and all what you have to do is walk through it with a basket over your head. The work of the Mujahideen is growing in bounds. While the different parties are bickering, the Mujahideen are busy laying the foundations for the coming of the rule of Sharia. For us down here, these are interesting moments we are living through. The battles in the southern parts of Yemen have led to the complete routing of the army forces and the clearing of the land from the filth of the corrupt Yemeni government. But there is a price for everything. During these great battles, we have lost some of our dear brothers, brothers from the first generation, the ones who were with us from day one. You will read about some of these martyrs in this issue. Last but not least, while we lament the loss of a great leader, we also congratulate our Muslim nation for the martyrdom of Sheikh Usama. He has waited for this moment for over 30 years. He lived a life of piety, gave up a comfortable life at an early age to join the Mujahideen in the mountains of Afghanistan, spent his wealth in the path of Allah, founded an organization that would lead the jihad in the path of... Well, I've lost my place here. Would lead the jihad of today and sat over the planning and execution of the greatest special operation of all time, the raids of Washington and New York. It was only befitting for such a life to end with martyrdom. Now Sheikh Ayman carries the banner. That's Ayman al-Zawahiri. He has been at the forefront of Islamic work and will now lead the organization he helped found. We ask Allah to assist Sheikh Ayman in this great task. Signed, Yahya Ibrahim. Now, they are admitting, I know, vomit toys, yes, as my co-host is saying in the chat room. Yeah, I'm sorry, it is pretty nauseating. But at least there is an acknowledgement here that they have been hit. They have been personally hit in Yemen by rebel forces. Now, they have these long screeds, and I don't really want to go into it too much in great detail, but they have these long forces, articles all about these wonderful mujahideen and how great they were and how well loved by their fellow jihadis they were and how they fell fighting for Allah. And it's so awfully badly written. Now, I think, you know, just to give a little sample of how badly written, Reese Reese is still available. Hello, Reese.
I'm here.
Hi there. Do you fancy reading that poem?
What did you send it? Because I don't remember seeing it.
Oh, I think it was on page 40. I sent you a link to download, didn't I?
Yeah, and I downloaded it.
No.
I don't remember which page.
Actually, no, it's not that page. It's a bit further on. It's actually on page 59. Do you want to read it?
I'll pull right up. I can't. If you can give me just a moment.
It's
I'm pulling it up right now.
Like really bad
it's
poetry
horrible.
At its worst, yes.
It's nauseating.
I know.
You said page 59, correct?
Yep. It's got a picture of a wood background with some little bits of sticky paper and photographs put on top. My beloved prisoners.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. My computer's going slow. Of course. Never fails, does it?
I can read it if you want. I mean, you know, it's just that
yeah.
People must be fed up with the sound of my voice by now. I'm getting fed up with the sound of my own voice, and that makes a change.
Oh, it's a lot of pages to load up, so it's taking its time. But,
okay, well, just shall I read it out?
Go ahead.
Okay. This is the sort of stuff that they are printing. My beloved prisoners, what can I say to you? The crimson water spilt in one land is the crimson water in the vials of my heart. The tears you suppressed in solitude, the pearls that I wished to siphon away and hide in my heart, those I desired one time, every time, to keep them unseen from the song-froid eyes of the Taghut. For how can coral hidden deep in serene waters be seen by the filth of the earth above? Submitted by Rashasha. Now, if that was a high school submission, I mean, I don't think it would even make the grade. The fact that they are printing such rubbish as that, that's I think the third time I've read it out aloud, and it's just absolutely dire. There's another poem here, a little bit better. I mean, try this one. I don't know if this is even any better at all, but it's not as dire as that last one. Progeny of the Exceptional, it is called. Our lasting fraternity will last for eternity. Oh, it rhymes. Gosh, that's good. At least the first couple of lines rhyme anyway. So that's a good start. I'll give it, like, you know, 2 out of 5 so far. All right. Our lasting fraternity will last for eternity. The deluded haven't yet realized you are savant. Oh, dear. The soaring bird sings tweet. Martyrdom kisses your... Oh, for God's sake, this is bloody terrible. I'm sorry, this is like a disgrace. This is an offence against the English language. Al-Qaeda should not be allowed to live if this is the crap that they're putting out and doing to my language. I'm sorry. Okay, the soaring bird sings tweet. Martyrdom kisses your feet. You left Dueling the Tower Geat, returning the treacherous heat, or Tower Geat, returning the treacherous heat, approaching from a line of prophets and martyrs combined, arrives a vast progeny holding paradise's keys, grander than any empire, serene as the wind's choir. Not a soul can acquire except by a soul's admire for the progeny of the exceptional. That is even worse than the last one. Unfortunately, it is so disgraceful that nobody has even bothered to put a signature to such crap as that. That is absolutely terrible. I'm sorry, you know. If I was that kid's school teacher, I would bloody expel him, you know what I mean? Sorry. That's disgraceful. Detention for 6 weeks until you can learn to like write proper poetry.
How? Well, they're saying in chat, have you spent in that would have failed high school English instead. Call me, mom. Says, have you been in a high school English class lately? And I'm thinking, oh yeah, I know. But at least they rhymed. They would have gotten an A for trying to rhyme.
Ah, now thank you, Findalis, in the chat room. Thank you very much, because this is what I wanted to hear, and I'm really glad this has happened, in the sense of I didn't waste a whole load of time saying this is what Muslims have done in Oslo, because Findalis has just sent a quote, and it is 32-year-old Anders Behring Breivik. He's the man who shot at children on Utøya Island in Norway, and his Facebook page reveals that he is from Oslo, Norway, and is a Christian Norwegian conservative. So, now, whether he is still a Christian Norwegian, I mean, it's still possible that he may have become a convert, but it is almost certain that if this is a bizarre political action or by somebody who has tipped himself over the edge of sanity, because I cannot see anyone murdering children for a political goal. Findalis is going out more and saying, thank you very much, Findalis, by the way, very appreciated. The 32-year-old Norwegian man arrested for gunning down children on the holiday island of Utøya has been named locally as Anders Behring Breivik. Described as 6 foot tall and blonde, he is reported to have arrived on the island of Utøya and opened fire after beckoning several young people over in his native Norwegian tongue. That's awful. Reports suggest he was also seen loitering around the site of the bomb blast in Oslo 2 hours before the island incident and also before the capital's explosion. And Call Me Mum's got an update. This is nice. Interactive. This is great. Where we all take part together. Update. The gunman reportedly had his own company dealing with geofarming, which would explain access to explosives. Geofarming, and that's to do with geology? I mean, stones, earth? I mean, I don't know really what geofarming is. And Iggy Mom, looking for the video news I saw earlier, but the friend of global jihad took responsibility for the blast. Yeah, because there were stories going around that this was almost certainly Islamist. But this is a very, very bizarre case. I personally cannot see anybody, if they have a political goal in mind, how are you going to achieve your political goals? Or live, you know, if you're going to kill children, you're going to end up in jail for the rest of your life, or for a very large part of your life. So if you really have a political goal, you're not going to be able to see that political goal come into being. It just defies belief. It doesn't seem to have any logic. I can't see what people hope to achieve by killing people. I can, more or less, I've become so inured to the excesses of Islamism where mad jihadists delude themselves by creating murder and mayhem that Allah is going to give them a special place in heaven with 72 virgins, raisins, pearly boys, and whatever else it is that's on the menu. But I cannot understand an individual doing something as horrific as this. It just defies belief. In the 1970s, if there was an explosion in Israel, the PLO would claim responsibility even if they didn't do it. That is interesting, yes. I don't know. It's very, very, very sickening. But if, until we've got any more information, then it seems that this is not an incident of Islamism. However, it is an incident of terrorism. And it is very interesting. Okay, he may have had access to explosives if he's involved in this geofarming. I'm not quite sure what it is. I mean, blowing things up. I mean, it's not mining, is it? It's not open cast mining. Now, according to Call Me Mom, he's got a Twitter account and he has only one tweet, and that reads, "One person with a belief is equal to the force of 100,000 who have only interests." Well, there you have it. We've learned, you know. So he's shown that he's got the force of 100,000 people. Well, obviously, it's not. I mean, Findale says this is not what Christianity is supposed to be. Well, obviously, it's not. Which makes me think that he might be slightly insane. I can't understand anybody doing that. As I said, I can just about understand jihadists because they have an irrational belief that killing will get them into heaven. But Christians aren't meant to believe that at all. And I think it's a disgrace that anybody who is a Christian can even consider shooting any child, no matter what age. A child is a child is a child, you know, and should, you know, be treated as sacrosanct. Yes, Mary, you were right. Unfortunately, Christians will be called terrorists by some people, but I think for the most part they won't. And then I think this is just, unfortunately, it will be in the way that, you know, the two quokwe argument goes on. Right, I endure is saying, this whole thing is a lie. I don't believe any of it. It is just a manipulation to make us believe something that's not true. Maybe. I don't know. Which is why I'm really glad. I mean, I was asked by my boss to write an article for Family Security Matters on this. And I don't think I'm going to write anything on this until more information is coming. Yeah, it's just going to be pointless. Because whatever I write, then I'll have to update and erase and change. God, they've already got a Wikipedia page already for him. Amazing.
Thank you, Call Me Mom.
I mean, oh, she's good, Call Me Mom.
She's quick, is what she is. I'm trying to find out.
Lightning fingers. Yeah, he's
trying to find out. I'm trying to find out specifically what geofarming is. All I'm coming up with is that it's a line of organically grown herbal products. Geofarming. So,
well, the prefix geo means earth, you know, like geology, you know.
Right.
Geofarming. I mean, unless it's geoforming, it's not geoforming, is it?
Well, let me see.
Geoforming.
Thermal farming. There's what kind of farming is it?
Let me start with my new window and type in geoforming, because I think geoforming would be probably more, you know, having watched Star Trek and, you know, terraforming.
But yeah, that's why I'm just trying to figure. It doesn't make. I mean, it just seems like it's probably just more close to the earth type farming. It's one of those.
Right. Well, there's a Bout Forum, Geoforming the Sahara Archives. I found a really interesting website dedicated to the geoformation or terraformation of the Sahara Desert. Okay. I mean, dear sirs, to speed up the geoformation that your website talks about, and it may sound a little Star Trek-ish, well, yes, because they always used to go on about terraforming planets, I came up with a fast, cheap solution to the enormous task ahead, blah, 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 about, he's talking about bombing the Sahara below the sand, and then you make glass, and then once you've got glass, then you make an artificial volcano on the desert surface. The beauty of this is that when the lava sets, the cooled rock is very fertile and life will soon take hold. And as a bonus, the process happens very quickly. Oh my gosh, yes. So, But it probably is geoforming rather than geofarming. You know, if that quote that came out that he managed to get hold of explosives, but I wouldn't allow anybody to go and, the idea of explosives, I mean, you know, when you had that March the 11th, 2004, when you had the massive 6 bombs which took place in Madrid train station, all of the bombs from there came from the Basque regions up in the north of Spain, and they were from mining companies. You know, it was some corrupt individual who was paid a lot of money to steal explosives used in the mining industry, you know, for open cast mining. And I believe it was open cast mining. Yes, it's just not good. Not good at all. Right, so we're still... still not sure. Farming underground and something to do with mushrooms. Most planting underground. Right. Oh, geofarm. Right. Thank you, Corbin.
Yeah, it's Berevic Geofarm is the company he works for.
It is geofarming. It's not geoforming then.
No, it's farm. F-A-R-M.
So how would he get access to explosives if he was working for a geofarming thing?
And I'm not seeing what it, you know, any explanation for it quite yet, but I have a number and all that jazz for the business right here.
So this is in
kind of
terms of, yeah, they're using nutrients to increase the fertility of the soil and the surrounding field.
And that would make sense if they're using chemicals for the soil.
Yeah, but I mean, those sorts of chemicals... I mean, you know, for example, there used to be the saltpeter man would be a familiar character in 17th century Britain. And anybody who had a dovecot or anybody who had a barn where cattle or horses would stay overnight, they would have to give to the saltpeter man all of the manure and animal effluent, which they would then use to create saltpeter, you know, because then that's one of the 3 prime ingredients of gunpowder. But gunpowder wouldn't create a bomb as big as that, though certain other bombs would. That's the other aspect why I didn't give the link to the Al-Qaeda magazine on the chat room, is because it has recipes for making ammonium... acetone peroxide, which is closely related to the triacetone triperoxide, which is what was used by the 7/7 bombers in London. And when you had the plot on August the 6th, I believe it was, 2006, no, August the 10th, 2006, you had a plot, all of the planes in Britain were not allowed to fly to America because there was a plot to have 5 different airlines have bombs put on them, and these were going to use ammonium peroxide, acetone peroxide, not triacetone triperoxide, but acetone peroxide. And there is a recipe for that chemical in the How to Create It from Household Items in the Al-Qaeda magazine. Fortunately, it goes on for 5 pages, and the version which I have has fortunately had the quantities blacked out, but there is still enough information there which I believe could lead to people using it. And because in Britain I could be jailed just for giving out that information, you know, there has been people who have been, you know, jailed before for deliberately sending out information like that. So unfortunately, I'm going to hedge my bets. I'm going to be cautious and not give out that. But it's, again, I think there was a desperation there. But so we basically have now come to the consensus, it seems, that the man who was going on, this Breivik guy, he Anders Behring Breivik, he is a nutter. He's a lone individual. and probably not part of any group. And it probably has nothing to do with Islam. So I'm glad that I was cautious at the start of the show, because this is something where... Oh my goodness, call me mum. That's a horrible thing from your wheelbarrow. What were you doing on a pile of manure? Nearly as tall as a one-story building.
She needs to call in so she can explain it.
Please do. I would love to know. Don't get it too graphic, but we've only got about, 13 minutes. If anybody does want to call in, call-in number for the guests is 347-857-1380. And I also have my sound effects, if you want. I was hoping I'd get a troll call in tonight, and then I could use my sound effects, but unfortunately no, so I'm a little bit disappointed. I was, hoping to use them. They're really good, I had a keyboard all at the ready. I had to fight the cat off to stop him from jumping all over it. But still, please, if anyone wants to call in and have a chat, we will do so, because we are coming to the last 10 minutes of the show, and it now seems that, now we know that this man has apparently political reasons. I don't know, he just doesn't wash. I mean, I don't care if he says he's a Christian. I mean, a lot of people say that they're Christian and they're not, you know what I mean? They may come from a Christian background, but I mean, there is nothing Christian in killing children, absolutely none. Oh, Mary, you don't ever call in. Shame. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Call me mum. Please call in. I'd love to know what you were doing on that pile of manure. Sorry. Please call in. I'll be waiting for you. There's two callers. Yes. Excellent. I'm going to... how do I
already
do
did.
It? Oh, yes.
Just keep it clean.
Oh, she will. Hello?
You're on, hon.
Hello?
You're on the
Hi
air.
Hi there.
How are you today?
I'm very well. Is that Call Me Mom?
It is Call Me Mom.
Great. How are you?
I am all right.
And yeah?
When I was younger, in college, I was interning on a trichiner farm because they were doing embryo transfers.
Right.
In the horse industry. And one of my jobs was cleaning stalls, and they had a manure pile that was as tall as a one-story building, and they had boards, like 2x4s only wider, going up.
Right.
And I'd have to run the wheelbarrow up the board to the top of the manure pile, walk along the top of the manure pile, and dump it so that it'd be towards the back as we built
right.
it gradually.
Ah.
And then I was back with the wheelbarrow. The wheelbarrow was in front of me. The front end of it caught on the board and flipped me right over.
Jeez.
Most unpleasant.
Yeah, I bet it was smelly too and messy.
Well, it wasn't as smelly and messy as you might think, because when it's in a pile like that, it dries out on the top fairly quickly.
Right, it gets across. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm making it graphic now. Yeah, but yeah, I do understand what you mean. Yeah, when I was 15, I worked in a large sort of superstore hypermarket, and we had a whole pile of, I was stacking piles of tins of creamed rice and creamed tapioca, and I was on the top of that and being fed, as I was on the top, people were passing me up more and more of these piles, and I was like making, I was about 6 or 7 foot high by that stage, and then the whole side of it collapsed, and I went bouncing down on my bottom over all of these, very hard edges of these cans of, rice pudding. Yeah. I was allowed an afternoon off work, so there was an advantage to it. But, yes. But, no, I mean, that's awful. So what do you think, personally, about this situation with this guy in Oslo?
Well, I just
from
don't
what
know
you hear.
What he think. I don't know what he possibly thinks he would be accomplishing by feeding children. It
yes.
Seems unlikely.
I know people keep saying
unbalanced.
Children. I'm gonna have to clarify something.
They're
people
teens,
keep saying children. But they're mid to late teens to mid 20s, so it's not like they're little 5 year olds that went
yeah,
to camp.
Yeah, they're not small children.
So,
they're still
yeah,
the beginning of their lives.
Right. When people think children, I don't know if the when I think children, I think of like 5 year olds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking teenagers and 20 year olds.
Yeah, we
know,
had a thing in Britain.
Now, so I'm like, oh no.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
No, I mean, it doesn't make it any worse or any better, but it just to clarify some of the facts so that people don't think that it's younger children who, are just if there was no chance in all creation that they of survival, at least when you're a teenager to older, you have some kind of chance of thinking through what to do. Not that they have
yeah,
much
but
help.
The thing is, Norway is a country where people don't carry guns, or they're not even expected to have guns at home. Policemen carry guns. This man poses a policeman, and what's so horrible is that, you know, whatever the age, these were young people
right.
at the beginning of their lives. They had
right.
no experience of how to deal, as you said, with
yeah.
self-defense. They had no means of self-defense because they didn't have any arms. This is like shooting fish in a barrel. It is very easy for somebody to make such a high kill count, you know, 20 people, because these poor kids didn't, and I'd say kids, you know, youth, you know,
right.
young people, had nothing to defend them. There were no other policemen apparently there. He had taken over the role of the police. So he must have used a lot of strategy and thinking if it is this one man. He's the person they said that he was seen 2 hours before at the site of where this where the car bomb had taken place.
Mm-hmm.
But it just defies belief. We had in Britain, in Scotland, there was a Dunblane massacre, where you had a man went to his former school, and it was a kindergarten school, and he children aged 5 and 6, and he killed 16 of them. There was another case of a paranoid schizophrenic who killed several children with machetes. He just went into a school playground and then just started hacking at them. He'd been working on his car and then said that God told him to go and kill children. He went into the playground and thought that he was confronted by devils, and so he hacked at these innocent children. And if it wasn't for the fact of this very brave woman teacher who received quite horrific injuries, he would have killed a lot more, but she took him on, you know, single-handedly. I mean, Horace Jarrett, I think his name is a very weird name. But, you know, I can't understand somebody doing that as a political statement. It shocks a nation. But if you were going to do that, you would have a manifesto. You would have something that you'd lodged somewhere that was going to be revealed at a certain time. I mean, you would reveal
but
a manifesto.
But who doesn't have something like that?
Well, perhaps, because, yeah. I mean, basically, he could have got killed if there had been other policemen there with guns. You know, they could have shot him, in which case, if he didn't have some manifesto to give to the world, whatever message, no matter how sick and twisted it might have been, or his methods may have been sick and twisted, it would never have got through to people. I just find it very, very, very upsetting to think that, you know, somebody... I know it's awful to say this, but I would have felt less disturbed to know this was just Islamism just carrying on a trend. Now, as somebody was saying in the chat room, that Christians are now going to be accused of being terrorists again. They used that with the Timothy McVeigh thing, you know, saying, oh, there's Christian terrorists too, you know. Okay, the Alfred P. Murrah building in 1995 in Oklahoma, I mean, I think there was about 170 people, you know, were killed in that incident. But that was,
And see, now there's, you know, Call Me Mom says there's an update according to the Norwegian Bruce Newt broadcaster TV. He was a Freemason. So, okay, now here we're going through the gambit of religious ideologies that could possibly be the cause of why he does what he does.
So now it's because he's a Freemason. Well, gosh, I mean, you know, you don't really associate, I mean, Freemasons are meant to be Freemasons because they get invited in because they've shown civic responsibility. You know, you don't just say, I'm going to become a Freemason. You get invited in there, and you only get invited to become a Freemason if you are showing yourself to have social responsibility, if you're showing yourself to be an upstanding citizen concerned for the general welfare of humanity and society. So I think he's probably just had some brain embolism.
Well, you know, it's just, it's kind of interesting because remember, I don't know if you remember this guy, but was it about a year ago or so when there was the guy that ran the plane right into the IRS building in Texas.
Right.
Do you remember that? And there, everybody's
it's
like,
about
oh,
2 years ago,
crazy.
I think.
Crazy. Yeah, and I think, I thought it was last year. But yeah, see, so, time, so much has happened betwixt and between. It,
yeah.
You know, who knows? But, you know, they were all saying, oh, it's one of those wacko Tea Party people, or it's one of those wacko right-winger neocons, whatever the heck that is. And
yeah.
What it comes down to is that he was a bit off his rocker, and he was angry at the IRS. He had been angry with the IRS, and the things that he expelled, you know, through his work and what have you, was extremely anarchist. And
I can understand to a degree a suicide attack. I think I'm making a statement. You know, and I'm blowing myself, you know, going postal is like when you reach the end of your tether and you make a statement, you know, and you expect to go down in a hail of bullets. It's like in Malaysia where people run amok. But and a bomb, I can almost understand somebody leaving a bomb because it's you're removed from your victims. You know, you don't see your victims. A bomb is a bomb and you don't have the direct connection. But to actually shoot people when you're pointing a gun at them, I don't understand it. I think it's time to close the show. We are coming to the very end. And I'd like to thank everybody. Thank you very much, Call Me Mum, for calling in. Thank you for everybody in the chat room. Thank you, Reese Cup. And we've only got a few seconds, about a minute. I'm going to play you out with a little bit of the Carter family. Bye-bye. We'll talk to you next week. Same time, same channel, Friday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio, Radio Jihad. Thank you very much. This has been Global Security Matters. Goodbye. The roses so red and the well. I don't know. I just think it's all very, very sad. I mean, it would have been sad no matter who did it. Anyone who's going to kill young people.
No matter what, it's necessary. And
yeah.
You know, I don't care what anybody thinks. It's not provoked.
Yeah, and I'm glad I held off on going too much into detail. You know, I gave the information. Yeah, I gave the information about the background of Islamism in the country, but fortunately held off from saying this is definitely Islam at fault, because, you know, I would have felt very embarrassed with a lot of egg on my face if I'd, you know, done any different.
Well, and you really don't know in the end until, well, it's
well, yeah,
the end.
We still, there'll be more coming out later.
I mean,
you know, we don't know anything until these things happen. And I was saying, you know, like, you get these cases of people, you know, traditionally running amok. You know, it's something that used to happen in Southeast Asia as a tradition, that people would have a ritual about it. They would have special baths. They would, you know, wear special clothing and then go out and... No, and it would be a form of suicide, very much like going postal, you know, in the sense of people know that once they start, everything gets too much and they go out and they start on a random act of murder, they know that they are going to probably almost 99% certain they're going to be shot down by police. And in a way, that's what they invite. And often these people do commit suicide at the end. You know, I believe the Don Blaine guy did commit suicide at the end of it, you know. Horace Jarrett, you know, the guy who attacked school children in Birmingham in the playground with a machete, he was genuinely deranged. He didn't know what he was doing, and even though what he did was just as horrific, his motives were different. He was deluded and deranged. And mental illness can strike people at any time, in any form. You know, so we still don't know the whole thing. And I think all we can say is that it was something terrible. It was something that we won't know probably for a few days, really, what was behind it. And probably then, not until he gets on trial.
Yeah. You know, and even then, who knows if we'll know anything. Because what it comes down to is if we're only going to get what he reveals, what they reveal, and...
Yep. I mean, I was very annoyed, you know, this sort of, you know, this thing in Germany, you know, there was this guy who was arrested on Wednesday who was said to be an Al-Qaeda recruiter, and they have a thing there, they only give out the first initial of a person's name. It's very frustrating because the guy is called Omid H. You know, so you can't go and start doing research to try and find background information on these people. You know, because you've got nothing other than a first name to go by and only one initial of the surname. And in a way, it's good because they protect the identity of the person until they've gone to trial. And as we, you know, as I sort of said at the beginning, everybody is innocent until proven guilty. In this case, the fact that, you know, he was the only person shooting, it's damn certain that this man was guilty. It just seems frustrating that, I don't know, that things don't get revealed. You know, I think that in a way it'd be nice to reveal everything right at the start, but then again, that goes against people's rights in a trial.
Yeah, and make sure before you leave tonight to check out the chat room. I'm not going to say this stuff so it's on the podcast, because, you know, we don't know if it's accurate or not, but this is what's being reported or what's being found, so who knows?
Oh, gosh, yes. Wow.
And who knows if that's true or not?
Isn't Courtney Mung good? What? Isn't she brilliant? She's really good with the, you know, lightning fingers. It's
she
really
is
good.
Very good. She does have those fast fingers. She gets that stuff really well.
Yeah.
So
and she's got a brain. I like that. Yes.
I like her brain too.
Okay.
She's
it's
fun.
Yes, I think it's. You know, I don't. I'm actually quite tired at the moment. I was.
Me too. Yeah. A long day. He takes me, just takes it out of you.
Yeah. So I think that I'm not going to carry on for another 55 minutes like I did last week. And I just think that, you know, really, this has been a very strange day in terms of news. And really, it was said in the chat room that this will be used to attack Christians with, but no, we'll see what happens. Okay, so anything you want to sort of close off with yourself?
No, that alone.
Okay.
I am perfectly good.
All right, then. In that case, I'm going to close us down now, and we will be back next week, Friday, on the 29th of July, at 6 o'clock Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio, Radio Jihad. I'm Adrian Morgan. I'm the editor of Family Security Matters. And my host has been Reese Cup, full of peanut butter goodness. And this is the end of the show, and I'm not even going to bother playing you out with music because we just had the Carter Family and Wildwood Flowers. So I will see you, hopefully, next week. Take care, look after yourselves, and stay out of trouble. Goodbye.
Night.